Freifahrt.
And this is the highest benefit for, I would say, enabling mobility as a service. It's really trying to democratize the process and really allowing for the broadest comparison for shared mobility to serve as that nudge for people out of their own private automobiles.
Willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Freifahrt, dem Interview-Podcast für eine neue und zukunftsfähige Mobilitätskultur. Mein Name ist Sebastian Hofer und hier frage ich mich und meine GesprächspartnerInnen sinnbildlich jede Woche wieder, weshalb es in Holland und Dänemark eigentlich selbstverständlich ist, mit einem Lastenfahrrad unterwegs zu sein und wir hierzulande immer noch kostenlosen Parkraum als Grundrecht verstehen. Mit euch zusammen möchte ich unser aktuelles Verständnis von Mobilität auflösen und an einer wünschenswerten Zukunft unserer Fortbewegung basteln. Von Mikromobilität bis zum Hyperloop. Und deshalb spreche ich mit allerlei klugen Köpfen, die uns auf neue Gedanken und Wege bringen wollen. Was können wir aus der Entwicklung des Sharing-Mobility-Marktes der letzten Jahre ablesen? Welchen Effekt hatte und hat Corona voraussichtlich bald wieder auf verschiedene Mobilitätsangebote? Und wie trägt das Konzept eines sogenannten Open Marketplace dazu bei, den heiligen Software-Gral namens Mobility as a Service endlich zu finden? Um diese Fragen zu beantworten, spreche ich in dieser Folge mit Scott Shepherd, dem Chief Business und Marketing Officer von IOMOB, einem der innovativsten Softwareunternehmen für Maas-Softwareprodukte aus Barcelona. IOMOB steht für Internet of Mobility und der Name alleine deutet bereits ihre ursprüngliche Vision an, ein dezentrales, Open-Source- und Blockchain-basiertes Ökosystem zu bauen, welches das Problem lösen sollte, den hochfragmentierten und sehr kompetitiven Markt an Mobility-as-a-Service-Apps, Aggregatoren und Anbietern zu vereinen. Und zwar in der Art, dass man statt eine neue White-Label-App zu programmieren, ihre Software zum Beispiel in bestehende ÖPNV-Apps einbaut und somit den Funktionsumfang um eine Vielzahl multimodaler Mobilitätsanbieter erweitert. Das machen sie auch immer noch, nur hat es nichts mehr mit Blockchain zu tun. Scott ist seit Jahren einer der umtriebigsten Mobilitätspioniere und beweist in seinen Beiträgen häufig einen kritischen, unkonventionellen und verknüpfenden Blick auf das komplexe Geschäftsmodell von Mobility as a Service. Genau deshalb und aufgrund seiner jahrelangen Erfahrung kann man mit ihm hervorragend über die Entwicklung des Mobilitätsmarktes philosophieren. Und genau das machen wir jetzt. Also, viel Spaß mit Scott Shepherd von IOMOB. Scott, you're probably one of the most visible, outspoken and active innovators, and maybe probably one of the knowledgeable ones as well in the mobility space. And you also are my first ever interview on my podcast. You probably remember at the Micromobility Industries conference last year in Berlin. It's pretty much 1 year ago.
Yes.
We had the first small conversation where you still worked for Free to Move. Mm-hmm. So happy to have you on my podcast again 1 year afterwards. Now you work for a different company and we have a little bit more time to talk about. So welcome to my podcast.
Thank you, Sebastian. It's a pleasure. I'm glad to join you a second time on this, and it was an honor to join you on your inaugural episode about a year ago, at Micromobility Europe in Berlin. So really excited to kind of talk everything mobility and shared economy today. I think this will be a lot of fun. I appreciate this.
So let's start with one assumption from my side. Looking at the Maas industry the last years, in my perspective, it's not really getting off the ground. Looking, for example, at Yelby, the Trafi implementation of Maas in Berlin, they hardly have a six-digit number of users comparing to the million people that live in Berlin and the people that commute into the city. It could be more. So apparently the value proposition is not attractive enough for people to use such Maas aggregator apps. What's your explanation? Do you agree on what you said, or do you have another explanation for that?
So, we have been going through quite a sea change in terms of a realization of the opportunities of Maas, one, and two, understanding some of the lessons learned in the ecosystem over the last 4 to 5 years. There have been many explorations related to business models, related to constructions of Maas, which I'll talk about, as well as which types of services can generate the best offer for consumers in terms of what we like to call app stickiness. So keeping individuals very much engaged in a digital experience, and then also related to reducing the barriers of entry into a shared service or a mobility as a service application. Getting to your point in terms of expectations related to number of users for large scale mass deployments, such as what you had mentioned in the city of Berlin and the deep integration of mobility service providers, which has been quite a achievement on the part of a white label app that is essentially orchestrated by a public transport authority. To my knowledge, one of the first in the ecosystem that has done so. And I applaud those efforts. And I also applaud the efforts that it is basically a door-to-door experience for that type of solution. What is really lacking is from what we see in terms of how these services basically address the entire landscape in terms of movement throughout a city. And I think that we are still in the infancy in terms of how we can basically capture the supply of mobility providers in an urban setting, and then to basically offer those into a platform that allows for comparison, choice, and availability. So it's a supply and demand question. And I think that the lower than expected number of users, either one time or return users, speaks to that gap in supply and demand related to the mobility as a service offer. It is not an easy task to achieve. And I would say many of the different operators in the ecosystem, whether it be Traffy developing the LB app or different offers, have quite a challenge in front of them in terms of basically demonstrating that, I would say, use case that is being, I would say, advertised to consumers, which is full supply, door-to-door availability, and full set of feature functions that allow a consumer to basically interact with one application and, again, reduce that friction in terms of wait times and in terms of being able to match or mismatch technologies. So that's just setting the stage for why the expectations have not realized, shall we say, the marketing, the communications, or dare I say, the hype of mass up until now in 2020.
Looking at the evolving mobility industry during the last years and, yeah, maybe the last decade, what kind of change and transformation did you observe for the different modes like car sharing, micromobility, or even ride hailing, given that you are closely monitoring this for quite some time now? And since I know that you're thinking about this a lot, how did COVID-19 influence the mobility landscape during the last months?
Well, we have a couple of things going on right now. We have growth or change in user adoption, and then we have, I would say, a transformation between modes that is evolving as well, too. And I think this would probably be best to frame in terms of the current environment that we are all experiencing right now, the global pandemic and COVID-19. And that is only accelerating some of the rapid changes in the mobility ecosystem for the sharing economy, if we want to call it MaaS or another type of application, related to the demand for, I would say, individual modes of shared mobility, so mobility service providers. And maybe we could segment those out for a moment and then talk about how COVID-19 is perhaps affecting a shift in individual mode. So what we have been seeing, and I will kind of look quickly at the North American market versus the European market and then talk about the different modes. up until I would say the advent of the global pandemic in March of this year, 2020, we'd already started witnessing amongst several of the large-scale MSP providers, more so in the car share industry in North America, not necessarily a decline, but perhaps a mismatch in utilization of supply versus demand in many different North American cities, specifically for car sharing. And a lot of the investments on the part of multinational automakers, OEMs, started basically shifting their resources out of the North American market, specifically to car share, because the demand was not matching what they had initially projected for the shared economy. And the car share industry was such that the supply of the individual vehicles, whether they be free-floating car share or station-based, typically work in higher density population centers with a rich public transport network. However, the specific cities where these programs were piloted or launched did not meet that specific demand. So that was, I would say, kind of a trend number one was, I would say, a miscalculation of demand on the car share side in the United States, which we also saw some interesting trends in Europe too, in several of the car share providers basically shifting their fleets and their services between European cities. We saw a bit of a transformation in the Iberian market for car share providers more into Central and Northern Europe, I would say in 2019 or early 2020. This all leads up into the global pandemic.
Did you also see some differences because of the cultural background of Southern and Northern European countries and maybe the role of a private car in Germany, which is very, very high, the status quo that is connected to that, and compared to Southern European countries where it's not like that, where it's more considered to be a means of transport rather than shaping your personality?
Yeah, indeed. And I would say what we had noticed in the car share market, basically fragmented amongst specific European regions, certainly in 2019, 2020, was a bit of a merger and acquisition on the part of the car share providers, certainly in Southern Europe, the Mediterranean region, so Spain, Portugal, Italy. We saw fewer car share providers, but the services were basically being centralized in the first and second tier cities, such as Lisbon, Madrid, Barcelona, Rome, etc. And we saw a few of the car share offers starting to basically drop off in the second and third tier cities. So that was one trend. And that was basically due to these offers consolidating related to consumer preferences of basically car ownership levels in Southern Europe have actually been increasing over the last 5 to 10 years as those offers have become more ubiquitous. So there's a bit less of a demand for sharing services related to individual automobiles in these markets versus, I would say, Central Europe, Nordics, and the Benelux region, which means that we've seen a bit of a shift in the demand on that side. While the German market is still extremely strong related to individual car ownership and consumer preference, public transport is ubiquitous and so rich in cities ranging from Munich to Hamburg to Berlin that the number of car share providers has remained quite steady, albeit there's been a shift in the different providers that have been present in the ecosystem. Kind of what we're focused on right now is just the individual mode of car sharing related to the MSP mix. But what we've also witnessed, kind of getting back to the first point, is that in this acceleration of trends, or shall we say, I'll use the term again, hype cycle, there was a lot of hype in the shared economy, car sharing, et cetera, certainly North America and Europe, and we're seeing kind of a transformation of players, operators, et cetera, moving cities, merging, acquiring, and actually dropping their offers in different markets. The mix of different modes of shared mobility, whether it be bike share, whether it be e-scooters, as well as ride share, has also been going through an interesting transformation too. Shall we speak about that in a bit more detail?
Absolutely, yeah, please go ahead.
Let's go through each one by one. Okay, so let's talk about kick scooters, e-scooters, et cetera. So huge peak hype in starting in North America, mid to late 2018. This translated to the continental mainland European market in early to mid 2019 with the regulation of kick scooters in Germany, as well as multiple markets. We saw a huge boom in the availability of providers and the number of units across European cities, ranging from Madrid to Paris to Lisbon, as well as even in the Nordics. And this continued quite steadily through the end of 2019, albeit governments and municipalities started smartening up and working more closely with the providers to either limit the use or position of kick scooters, or to enact either strict or smart regulations related to how the placement could be aligned with policy and legislation for mobility infrastructure. Now, as we moved into 2020 now, in terms of COVID-19, so this is kind of the overarching theme here, is how each mode of mobility has shifted pre and post COVID-19 is a sudden and severe drop in ridership globally worldwide in kick scooters. So those were one of the modes that were the most affected, other than ride hail, related to the shared economy.
Which is interesting, because especially bike sharing or cycling in general has experienced quite a boost.
I know.
In European countries, and Paris being the city where the mayor Anne Hidalgo has started to construct like hundreds of kilometers of cycling ways. I was wondering why the e-scooter market had such a fall in user numbers that you just mentioned. So the idea of having an individual means of transport, which is pandemic safe, or
mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there's a kind of a cultural and educational notion in terms of which mode of mobility is considered the safest or the healthiest in light of the global pandemic we're still battling right now. Now we're encountering the second wave here in Europe. So I believe, this is just my personal kind of take on this, is active transportation can be perceived as the healthiest personally and socially. This complies with social distancing, I would say, regulations, as well as, I would say, public health. So if an individual is out and about walking individually or taking a bicycle, it is perceived that you're maintaining a level of comfort and distance from others, but you're participating in an activity that is very active and engaging, and this helps to, one, spur the economy, two, it's environmentally sustainable, and three, it's seen as a social good. And because I would say kick scooters, they were in a very nascent, shall we say, kind of hype development in the year preceding COVID, they had not basically entered in the common collective culture of mobility related to European inhabitants, cities, and existing infrastructure. So I don't think that the adoption, certainly during and throughout the pandemic, was perceived as a preferred mode to basically counterbalance perhaps public transport. I personally think there's not necessarily a lot of logic to it, because you would imagine that kick scooters themselves could maintain social distance. There are a last mile solution that allows you to maintain your personal space, and they serve a very vital gap in the last mile connectivity within different modes. But what we're seeing is, I think, given the existing and rapid increase in infrastructure expansion, physical infrastructure, whether they be quick pop-up bike lanes, whether they be new walking paths, etc., consumers were just preferring to either use their own bicycles, use shared bicycles, or just to get out walking. And these are some of the strong trends we've been noticing, certainly in European cities over the last 6 months. So this is another modal shift or trend that we've seen during the global pandemic.
So if active and individual transport like bike share or walking seems to be benefiting from this pandemic, what about ride hail as another form of individual transport, especially now that summer is over and temperatures are falling? I know that you're living in Lisbon, but at least for Northern Europe and for Germany. So what effects did you watch on ride hailing, and do you have some kind of forecast for this part of the mobility landscape?
They're taking the biggest hit right now. I would say of all the mobility mix, I would say ride hail is taking the biggest hit right now.
Even bigger than public transport?
Maybe, okay, so maybe not in as big as public transport, but for the MSPs, the most significant hit. Although I would say there's individual operators that have quite a smart growth strategy and have a long-term vision post-pandemic, such as Bolt out of Estonia, one of Europe's largest ride-hail operators, and they see the global demand for ride-hail as surpassing what we're experiencing right now, which has really hit some of the U.S. ride-hailers really hard. So it depends on their appetite for internal investment and subsidies. Now, getting back to kind of the rounding out the mobility mix and what we saw pre and post-pandemic, so let's talk about public transport and maybe finish that up with demand response transit, or as what they call in the United States, micro transit. So just public transport in general, bus, rail, tram, et cetera. Yeah, we all know the horror stories, 80 to 90% drop in ridership. Many different public transport authorities are now back to about 60 to 70% of normal ridership pre-pandemic. So that's still a 30 to 40% drop. That's massive revenue loss at what we Americans call the fare box. So that's fare box revenue that's not being captured. That has to be subsidized by somewhere. And that's being subsidized by the taxpayers, obviously. So what is preventing a full return? Well, we're not out of the woods yet. We're in a second wave of the pandemic. We have another wave probably to come too before we're completely through this entire battle. Hopefully sometime next year, we'll see. And we have a layer of cultural factors now for public transport. So what is seen as a really intrinsic or collective value of public transport as benefiting the commonwealth of the health of a society? Well, I would argue that many European countries, cities, municipalities, regions have demonstrated through a high level of investment, quality, I would say availability and reliability of public transport in, I would say, a broad region of European municipalities, that it is just part of a necessary layer of our infrastructure that drives our everyday quality of life. So public transport is as necessary as public health or as hospitals or as schools. So it's just part of the regime that is connects our society. I would argue that public transport in North America, or specifically the United States, does not have that level of support or societal acceptance. And given that, it is always kept, as we call it, on life support. It's given a very minimal level of funding, whether it's political or monetary. And any specific shift in demand, or let's say change in society, such as a pandemic like this, will just completely dismantle its reason for existence. Not only that, but many public agencies and entities in the United States take a very hands-off approach. So it's not as centralized, the governments and their control of the operations of public transport. So to use the French term, but also to coin the economist Adam Smith, it's laissez-faire, it's hands-off. So a PTA in the US is going to be much more hands-off for the operations and I would say control and mix of public transport and linkage to shared mobility providers than you would find in European municipalities and regions. So given these two differences on both sides of the Atlantic, yes, we see still, I would say, a 30 to 40% drop in total ridership currently in Europe right now. We're seeing probably even greater drop currently in the United States. And it's going to take much longer for U.S. public transport to rebound than even European public transport, given these different factors. So that it focuses on that mode of mobility. But I am very optimistic, and it's been proven in many different articles and academic journals that COVID itself is not a vector public transport or cities in general and high density cities are not vectors for the spread of COVID-19 and coronavirus in general. So it was fearful that high density population centers, whether it be Tokyo, New York, Seoul, Singapore, basically spread the transmission of the virus just by close quarters. And that's been proven to be false. And it's also been proven to be false that just ridership in public transport, whether it be subways, underground, buses, et cetera, also serve as a channel for transmission. That's also been proven to be false too, along with proper sanitation and use of masks, et cetera. So given these kind of myths have been dispelled, and I think to use the term return to normalcy, once we kind of combat the virus, either through kind of different mechanisms, I foresee a positive path forward for public transport in serving maybe not necessarily just central business districts. And this has been an interesting article I just read about recently, actually by one of my colleagues, Rachel Zack at Remix in San Francisco, California. She just wrote about this and I thought it was excellent. She talks about how the return to normalcy in our commuting patterns is not going to serve necessarily downtowns or central business districts. It's going to be much more neighborhood based. So a lot of the commuting patterns, whether it be public transport as the backbone, complemented by shared mobility, is going to be polycentric and neighborhood to neighborhood. And I think that's genius, an idea, because really this is a much more sustainable form of, I would say, urbanization as we move into, as we continue in the 21st century. It's not quite as binary where everyone in a peak travel pattern, you know, 6 to 9 a.m. rushes into the center of the city and then departs in the evening period. So you have two peaks. You have multiple peaks, multiple areas, and it's a much more sustainable movement of people and goods throughout urbanized regions. And I see that as actually a very positive outcome, and public transport can still serve as the backbone, hopefully certainly in European cities, to support that type of movement, complemented with the mobility service modes that we had just talked about previously on this podcast.
And it works well with the 15-minute city of Paris and the concept of Professor Carlos Moreno,
yes,
who thought about this, or the neighborhood idea that you have most of the daily needs in walking distance. Absolutely. That's also something that I am envisioning, and I'm hoping that this is some kind of outcome of this pandemic.
A very, very positive
outcome, definitely, which reduces traffic. And speaking of reducing traffic and also vehicles, I recently started to think about whether shared micromobility in the actually required ubiquitous manner is viable at all to serve the highly individual day-to-day needs that we all have, where a private bike, for example, seems to be the perfect product. And looking at myself, I hardly use shared micromobility services, at least in the city where I live. And It's only occasionally, and of course, it's much different in other cities. But I'm wondering if the energy, the resources, the effort that's needed for operating each of these services will ever meet the demand of all the people out there using these services, especially in the future 15-minute city concept. So it feels like the big promise of providing a bicycle or an e-scooter at any place, at any time, is just not realistic. And if I'm constantly disappointed because there's no supply, I probably won't build up the trust as a user. So what is your take on this?
Okay, so I think there's maybe two or three or four different scenarios we can kind of paint a picture. One are, let's talk about multimodal mobility hubs. So those serve as kind of a geographic nexus or a center to provide for potential demand for mobility suppliers to offer their services related to different forms of travel. These multimodal hubs can either serve daily commuters, they can serve intercity travelers, or they can serve visitors to a city. Why these hubs are important is because by smartly and carefully positioning shared services, while they could be balanced related to the number of passengers or inhabitants that basically engage in these hubs on a daily or hourly basis is important. There's an opportunity for mobility service providers to basically commercially profit and benefit and provide a valuable service to basically fill in those gaps. So I think mobility hubs are a very interesting opportunity that these shared services, whether they be pedal bikes, electric bikes, e-scooters, et cetera, can still basically provide that gap for perhaps individual inhabitants, local inhabitants that already use their own personally owned bicycles or scooters. So that's one area. Another interesting area is active transportation. So active transportation itself, by definition, is typically just walking or pedal biking, pedal cycling. It's not even electric biking because you're not using your muscles, you're not using your energy, it's not active. So,
At least a little bit for pedal bikes, at least you have to use your muscles a little bit to get the support for the bike.
Yeah. It's the greenest. So per se, does active transportation itself translate to a commercial and economic opportunity for the shared economy and mobility service providers per se itself? Quite limited, except for the pedal bike, either station-based or dockless pedal bike providers. So there's a limited market for that, and the individually owned bicycles would take up a large share of that mode. So I think that there is a limited opportunity in that scale. What I would like to say on that front is, though, active transportation can still serve as a catalyst or door to these other services. So it's, again, the most simplified mode of mobility. So maybe in the 15-minute city, you engage in active transportation for your daily walk to the grocery store or your pedal bicycle trip to the park, et cetera, which is fine on a very routine basis, and you maintain ownership of your own bicycle. But this serves still as a catalyst or template for when you're traveling to these mobility hubs, other cities, and these can basically, again, using nudge theory, introduce individuals, travelers, as well as others into other shared services where you're not going to be traveling with your bicycle from Zurich to Milan to Barcelona, et cetera. You're going to be basically trialing out different shared services in cities, which may or may not be similar to the 15-minute experience that you have in your home city. But again, it serves as the basis for the opportunity in terms of having this demand of customers, potential demand, basically utilize these types of platforms. That's another area.
But then if I get you correctly, then what you say is that most of these services are there to serve the occasional demand, the occasional use case, mainly from, let's say, tourists, business tourists, but it's not for daily use. Is that what you wanted to say?
I think there's a mix. So for shared mobility services that are positioned at mobility hubs, rail stations, and other multi-use centers, I would say a large component of those would be for more infrequent travelers. There's a high volume of those travelers visiting those cities, but they are on an infrequent basis. The more frequent travelers that would participate in the shared services would perhaps be on a more neighborhood basis for docked bike programs, as well as other dockless scooter and bike availability positioned in different neighborhood hubs. And these can serve as a complement to individuals that own their own active form of transportation. But I think what you're, and I agree with what you're saying, is that some of the highest opportunity is in the multimodal transport hubs and centers where you have a lot of the infrequent travelers, but the demand and the volume is high enough either on a business or touristic case that it becomes still quite profitable for MSPs to participate in these types of services that they're providing.
Before we talk about the business models of MaaS and what you at IOMOB do differently, I'd like to invite you on a little game. I'll read out two words, names, or options, and I'd like you to answer as quickly as possible without thinking too long about the two options. Are you ready? Should we start?
Go, yeah.
Bicycles or e-scooters?
Bicycles.
Subway or ride hail?
Subway.
Cycling or walking?
Walking.
Owning or sharing?
Sharing.
Free-floating or hybrid?
Hybrid.
Alone or together?
Together.
City center or suburban areas?
City center.
Urban planning or participation processes?
Urban planning, it's got to be.
Portugal or Spain?
Oh, boy. I'm not going to be popular. So I have to say Portugal. My wife's Portuguese and I live in Lisbon, so yes.
Fair enough. America or Portugal?
Gosh. Well, I live in Portugal now. Even though I'm an American, I still have to say Portugal. My heart.
America or China?
Oh, gosh. okay, fine. America.
Pay-as-you-go or bundling?
What's that?
Pay-as-you-go or bundling?
Pay-as-you-go, definitely.
Free of charge or the good old 365 euro ticket from Vienna?
Free of charge or what was that?
The good old 365 euro ticket, the 1 euro ticket each day from Vienna.
I would be free of charge.
Anne Hidalgo or Sadiq Khan?
What was the first one?
Anne Hidalgo or Sadiq Khan?
Ah, that's a good one. I would say Sadiq Khan.
Superblocks or Alfama?
I got to say Alfama.
Prohibitions or rewards?
What are rewards?
Prohibitions.
Oh, rewards.
Open data or not?
Ooh, that's tough. Do I have to answer one or the other? Or can I say both?
You have one joker to say, skip the question.
I better skip the question on that.
All right, then the competition or tendering processes?
Oh, competition, definitely.
Sustainable or fast?
Sustainable.
Partner or customer?
Partner.
Joint venture or partner?
Partner again.
All right, that's it. Thank you.
Love that, actually.
Why do you think it's tough that you said open data or not?
It's all because of the legal challenge happening in Los Angeles right now between American Civil Liberties Union / Uber versus the City of Los Angeles Department of Transportation. I support and I oppose both sides. I think both sides are good and both sides are bad in terms of this battle for open data related to the mobility data specification standard, the agency API. I think that it's really circumspect why perhaps Uber does not want to share their data, yet they're being held up as a champion for personal data privacy, which I support. Yet on the other hand, I understand the city of Los Angeles's need to better control and orchestrate shared mobility data for policy planning and regulation of the public right-of-way. But they have not made a good case in terms of why they need a real-time positioning of e-scooter and bike share data and how they're going to be using or protecting that data. So it's a really strong argument or disincentive on both sides. And I support and oppose both sides equally. And I'm just wondering where that case is going to land, because that's going to serve the basis for case law in the United States for years to come in terms of data sharing for shared micromobility, because there is no GDPR. If you had GDPR in place in the US right now, none of this would even be going to court. So I'd say having smart data protection policies in place like the European Union has, if the United States already had that, then there would be complete transparency and you wouldn't have people going to lawsuits to gain clarity in terms of how these types of services need to be operated.
And why did you pick the London mayor over the Paris mayor?
Oh, Saad, I thought it was, I'm sorry, I thought it was the head of the New York City Planning Commission, Janik Sadiq Khan. Oh, Sadiq Khan was the London mayor. If that was the case, I would choose Anne Hidalgo, definitely. I was a little challenged by that because of her support of the 15-minute city. So I need to change my answer.
Well, that's the beauty about the game.
Yeah, I thought you were saying the head of the New York Design and Planning Commission, because I was confused.
No worries at all. So let's go into the different business models of mobility as a service. David Zippon, an author at the Bloomberg City Lab, wrote quite an interesting article about the problems of mobility as a service business model. And I would like to talk with you a little bit about this, because I know that you're quite knowledgeable about the idea of the business model behind mobility as a service, and also going into the different take that you at IAMOP have on mobility as a service, not providing a white label mass app, but more providing the tech stack to broaden the scope of a legacy PTO application of different regions. And maybe start off with the question, what do you think are the issues or the problems of the regular mass business model based on collecting fees based on every right that people buy using a aggregator app, maybe?
Yeah.
Is that something where you see the biggest problem, or do you see other issues like regulation, governance, technical possibilities of PTOs? So
yeah, I think the kind of the standard, or what I like to call version 1.0 mass, is the business to consumer model. And that was the model that was widely scrutinized in the article that you speak of in Bloomberg City Labs about a month ago. That's kind of the standard mass aggregator model, which is basically integrate, depending on what level of integration you can, as broad a supply of mobility service providers as possible. And then again, as you had mentioned, collect the fees based upon a revenue split of either bookings, transactions, et cetera. So it's a revenue share model. This has not been proven, this has been proven to not be commercially viable across a wide variety of the mass operators over the last 2 to 3 to 4 years, given the level of user acquisition vis-a-vis marketing costs that are required to basically target demand consumers to drive levels of revenue that could sustain a service. One is not sustainable. And two, the commercial models that mass providers have introduced by just collecting these fees, but not looking at any other type of opportunities, has basically been proven to be an area where the development and integration of the consumer offer is not necessarily matching what can be projected for this demand in the ecosystem. So what I'm speaking about here is basically this type of, I would say, first level mobility as a service business model, a business to consumer, is unfortunately just not profitable for the mass providers if they're solely reliant on a revenue share of transactions. The volumes are just not such that they can make this balance off. So what many of the mass providers have been focused on in a transformation, including Free to Move, the firm that I represent, I'll talk about that in a moment, is a shift towards more intrinsic values of what type of service mass can offer society, I would say cities, as well as governments. And what we're seeing right now is quite a interesting shift away from B2C to, we would call it business to business, B2B to C, or business to government, B2G to C. So more of an indirect offer where the mass provider basically develops a white label solution, a customized application either for a corporation, this is the business to business offer, and they broaden that to either their employees or to other inhabitants that are trying to promote shared sustainable mobility, either for corporate sustainability initiatives or other benefits. And these types of offers are typically monetized or charged either through a revenue share with MSPs, but that's also layered with a subscription fee or a software license fee. So this is another revenue stream that mass providers can look to capitalize on. So that's one area. Quite similar to this is more on the public sector, the government side, which is more the business to government model. And that, again, is more of a white label solution, but this could be branded for a public transport authority, PTA, a city, et cetera. And they want to basically provide mass to their inhabitants. This is basically done, again, through a white label application. And they have the governance and authoritative structures in place to basically set up a framework such that specific mobility service providers are evaluated and integrated based upon a set of criteria. And then they've basically set up and orchestrated their own public sector mobility as a service platform. So this would be kind of similar to the offer that we see in Berlin, the Yelby app.
It's actually what most of the German cities are currently doing. Is
they're starting to do this now. They're following that model. Munich is, as well as others. So we can call this kind of the public sector white label app, run by a PTA. Yeah. So that's, and these two models were not really spoken about in, or alluded to in that Bloomberg article, which is quite interesting because it was really kind of focused on the more legacy business models or the larger players that really followed suit, such as CityMapper, Transit App, Uber, et cetera. But it didn't really focus on this interesting pivot we're seeing in the ecosystem right now. Now, the firm that I represent as Chief Marketing Officer, IMO, the Internet of Mobility, we actually take kind of a unique blended approach. We don't take necessarily an approach that is application that is completely operated solely by a public authority, a PTA, and we don't take an application that is completely privatized either, let's say like by an Uber. What we offer is we enable mass. So we don't build mass, which is very interesting because our offer is much more aligned with mobility on demand, which is a broad range of shared mobility services. And our platform is basically not a white label application, we enable MaaS for either public authorities or private corporate entities to deliver MaaS to their consumers. And we do this by licensing. This is how we monetize our software development kit or our API into existing applications. So we insert or layer specific services such as the integration of mobility service providers, journey planning, as well as intermodal routing into existing business to consumer offers to basically enrich and fill in the gaps in their ecosystem. So we're not looking to basically build a standalone application, but basically really try and further deliver the value such that clients of ours can really fully realize that consumer experience, increase app stickiness for their offer, and to again reduce those barriers to entry, whether it be on the public and private side. What we like to do, and this is really part of our ethos and our philosophy, is an open mobility marketplace is what we deliver through Mobility on Demand. And we try to prevent walled gardens. And walled gardens can be either of the private flavor or the public flavor. You can have a privatized walled garden where only a few mobility service providers are enabled and consumers are basically kind of trapped into that interaction. But you can also have a public sector walled garden too. I think we spoke about some of these instances as well, where a public authority basically retains complete full control and orchestration of the mobility services, which is fine, but it serves as a monopoly as well too. So by enabling and empowering clients, whether they be public or private, to basically set up the framework and the rules and governance for shared mobility, this opens up the marketplace for their offer or for competing offers, other, let's say, private sector mobility MaaS providers, to plug and play into this marketplace. And this is the highest benefit for, I would say, enabling mobility as a service, is really trying to democratize the process and really allowing for the broadest comparison for shared mobility to serve as that nudge for people out of their own private automobiles.
I first learned about IOMOP, the so-called Internet of Mobility, back at Hamburger Hochbahn. I remember I was intrigued by the idea because my understanding was that you're offering some kind of aggregated pool of mobility service providers that can be then integrated into each mobility app of a local public transport provider like Hamburger Hochbahn or the PTA, HVV in each city of the world potentially. And then I like the idea that I would be able to use my local app in Hamburg and travel to Barcelona, for example, where you guys are based. And I could still use the same app and also
exactly.
mobility services that I am used to use and that are available in both cities, be it bike share or car share or ride hail. Is that still the vision you're working towards?
Absolutely. And so thank you for kind of completing the story here, because actually I left that out. So I really appreciate that.
Is
that
You're welcome.
Global mobility roaming capability. And that's a huge, unique selling proposition on the part of IOMOP, is you do not have to download multiple apps when you travel from region to region. So in the case of the project that we're delivering right now in southern Sweden, in Malmo, with a partnership with Skåne Trafiken, the public transport authority, as well as other stakeholders, including Innovation Skåne and the cities of Lund, Malmo, and Helsingborg, in partnership and support of the Swedish national government and other government agencies, is developing that open ecosystem MaaS platform that, in theory, you'll be able to interact with the Skåne Trafiken public transport app powered by IOMOP's SDK for shared mobility. And then again, you could travel from Malmo to Copenhagen and then down to Paris, Lisbon, et cetera, and you would still have the availability to tap into those functionalities all within the same application. And this just serves as the higher level of, I would say, integration, societal, as well as technological level 4 integration of mobility as a service MaaS, and it's something that has been discussed quite frequently by many different non-governmental organizations, including I would say MaaS Alliance, including ITS America and others, is what is the highest value of MaaS for inhabitants? And it's really that ubiquity, that democratization, and that ability to have the seamless flow of goods and movement for inhabitants. And again, this is a very key point, is not having to download an individual app by an individual PTA city by city, because that just reduces the value proposition for why a consumer would even interact or want to consider MaaS in the first place. Because that's a barrier to entry right now, is that you travel from Berlin, you have one app, travel to Munich, you have another app, travel to another city, et cetera, et cetera. So that's exactly what we would like to try to avoid in that scenario.
Doesn't that mean that you hand over the responsibility of a viable business model to the PTO eventually?
Indeed. So this is all certainly client-centric. So this is a commercial business venture. So the control, the orchestration, the framework, the I would say the business use cases are all governed and strategized by the client. And typically, for the business to government to consumer model, B2G2C, that logical point of entry is a PTA typically, or a regional authority. And they would serve as the central orchestrator for these services. They may or may not procure the services, they may or may not own the services, but they serve as that logical node in this, shall we say, hub and spoke framework, such that they are able to best assemble and orchestrate these different modes for what makes sense for a particular region to increase the ability for consumers to interact with either their application or a competing application that wants to plug and play into that marketplace. So long answer to a short question on your part, yes, there has to be a central node, and that's typically serviced best by our clients, whether it be in the government sector or in the private business sector. And in the private business sector, that would be our clients, whether they be in a variety of business verticals, ranging from banking to insurance to commercial real estate to professional services to, shall we say, environmental sector. And they would be interested in procuring their own mobility as a service platform powered by our SDK to round out their, in this case, employee offer. And their employee offer would be typically a mobility budget or a benefit that they offer to their employees, such that they can nudge those people out of their own automobiles or the corporate car. So it's a new benefit that they offer as part of their salary structure.
And would you say that this approach kind of ends the hype cycle that you mentioned earlier, in terms of if a PTO or PTA is now in charge, the open competition kind of ends, because there's kind of a funnel where you have maybe one, two, or maximum three, I guess, MaaS operators in one city. So the competition isn't as it is these days, where all kinds of mobility service providers, especially micromobility, are fighting for the right to stay.
Yeah, so you have competition on the part of MSPs against each other, and then you have a competition of MaaS apps or MaaS providers against each other, and then you have a competition of regions or cities or PTAs against each other. So I guess it depends on where the competition lies, but I would say that a open MaaS marketplace or framework definitely levels the playing field. It democratizes the ecosystem and allows for more transparency, such that it's not necessarily a monopolization or a winner-take-all, but there are indeed very unique, interesting consumer offers and use cases that can be layered in related to points of interest, related to ancillary mobility services and consumer offers that each individual MaaS provider or operator can offer their own consumers. And they can basically tailor those customized services based upon their target audience. So you can have many multiple, I would say, platforms running under a, a shared framework or marketplace that allow and actually expand the market demand. Whereas many, I would say, because what have I read recently? Many mass apps and providers really only service about 5% of an urban population. So the consumer demand is still huge. And I think that that demand is not being captured because, again, the either the supply or the consumer offers are not matching the potential latent demand using nudge theory and these particular digitalized solutions that can be brought to market. So I would say, one, it's going to be less winner take all, and two, you're going to actually untap new markets that have not been penetrated in this version 1.0 mass, which was described previously by Bloomberg City Lab. I tend to be quite optimistic about the future, and the marketplaces and the business models are much more complex than what have been alluded to in the past.
Scott, thank you so much for your time and this really interesting conversation about the shared mobility space, about the implications of COVID-19, and of course also the business models of mobility as a service. And good luck with your pilot project in the southern area of Sweden and the Skåne area, and hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you, Sebastian. It's always a pleasure, and I'm glad we were able to reconnect again. I'm always a huge supporter of your podcast and your efforts in Germany and across Europe, so it's an honor to be part of this.
Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Und vor allem geht an euch nochmal ein großes, großes Dankeschön raus für die Treue, den Support und das Interesse an Freifahrt über das letzte Jahr. Ich freue mich auf jeden Fall schon sehr auf das nächste Jahr mit euch. Und worauf ihr euch freuen könnt in der nächsten Folge, ist das Gespräch mit Felix Petersen, dem Head of Europe des amerikanischen Scooter-Sharing-Anbieters Spin. Und ich frage ihn natürlich vor allem, Felix, warum brauchen wir einen weiteren Scooter-Sharing-Anbieter in Deutschland? Wenn euch das interessiert, freue ich mich sehr, wenn ihr dann mal wieder reinhört. Und wenn dir die Folge gefallen hat, dann freue ich mich wie immer natürlich auch über deine Unterstützung. Am einfachsten geht das, wenn du bei Spotify oder in deiner Podcast-App auf Abonnieren klickst und natürlich auch mit ein paar Sternchen und einem Kommentar bei Apple Podcasts. Außerdem freue ich mich, wenn du diesen Podcast fleißig weiterempfiehlst. Wenn du Kontakt aufnehmen möchtest, findest du mich bei LinkedIn, Instagram oder Twitter unter dem Namen Freifahrt. Das war's für heute mit Freifahrt. Mein Name ist Sebastian Hofer und ich freue mich, wenn du in der nächsten Folge wieder reinhörst und sage gute Fahrt und lass die Haare wehen.